This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, grandparents' rights, prostitutes v. pimps, and still-seeking African debt relief. Joining us from our bureau here in New York City is Bob Meadows, a writer with People magazine. At our Chicago bureau, Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, and George Curry joins us. He's editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, and he joins us from Maryland. All right, folks, let's look at something interesting coming out of Washington State, and that's a ruling this month by the state Supreme Court, which strikes down visitation laws for grandparents, leaving them with no legal recourse when the children's parents deny them access to their grandkids. Laura Washington, what's your thought here?
I think this is another example of us trying to mediate relationships through the courts. And we just had a big obvious example around this issue related to the Terri Schiavo case, which is, of course, a different kind of situation. But you're talking about relationships here. You're talking about fractured relationships in many cases, grandparents who have been cut off from their children and their grandchildren in some cases, and they're trying to get their rights. But I think that this is not the place to help these families. As some experts have said, you need to start with, you know, counseling, mediation. You need to try to work these things out within the families. In Illinois, the problem here is not, you know, the issue of grandparents being kept away from their kids. Here you have a situation where grandparents, in many cases, are embracing kids through the foster care system. Illinois has had a lot of success in bringing families back together by placing children with the grandparents in situations where the parents are unable to care for them.
But what's interesting,
I think
here,
that's a positive story.
What's interesting,
I think
here,
this court issue is nonsense.
What's interesting here, Bob Meadows, is that it was a unanimous decision. And the court ruled that parents have a right to raise their kids according to their wishes and values. And if they choose not to integrate them into their parents' lives, they should be allowed that.
That makes a lot of sense to me, actually. I mean, you have to support the parents, I believe, at all times. You have to let parents run their households. You have to let them set the guidelines for their children. The parents know. A lot of times parents have bad situations with their own parents, and they know what happened when they were younger, and they don't want their parents inflicting certain values on their children or interfering or what have you.
What if it's a case of something that isn't as cut and dry as that? As we know, unfortunately, families get bogged down in a lot of things. Grandma won't loan me the money that I need to buy a new refrigerator, so for punishment, I'm not going to let you see the kids.
You will definitely run into that, absolutely. But again, this is a situation, again, the parents, they have to be the ones in charge. Grandparents often
good, bad, or ugly.
Good, bad, or ugly.
George Curry?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I want to go back to the point that Laura raised. I mean, basically, you know, the court, I mean, you can't do this with law. You do need counseling and mediation services available. I mean, there's no question. You know, the parents have that right. Now, the problem gets complicated when you're a couple is divorcing or never married, and then one wants one thing and one wants the other. But still, I don't think you can do that with the law.
I think if you just look at custody fights over children between parents and how damaged children can be when there's a lot of friction and when things get into court, you have children ending up having to testify in custody cases. This is just another layer and another opportunity for the children to be put in the middle and victimized.
Well, here's something that could be said possibly by some where the court should not go. And this coming out of Chicago, your town, Laura, here we go.
Yes.
There is a proposed bill that would allow prostitutes to sue their pimps. The Predator Accountability Bill, a law that would give prostitutes the right to file a civil suit against their pimps for monetary damages as well as pain and suffering.
Wrong-headed, well-meaning, but wrong-headed. This bill comes out of an effort by the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless, which is a nationally recognized group that does great work around homeless issues. And, of course, many prostitutes are homeless. It's an opportunity, they say, and the legislators who support this bill say, to give women an out, to give women a chance to start afresh. But there's so many other things, and I've done a lot of reporting on this issue, and I've talked to a lot of former and current prostitutes. And the issues for them are not, you know, going back and getting money, you know, pain and suffering from their pimps. They need to get on their feet. They need drug treatment in many cases. They need HIV counseling. They need shelter. They need jobs. And any legislation that's being should be put forward, I think, should focus on those issues and should also focus on holding pimps accountable for their own crimes. It, here in Chicago and in Illinois, a very tiny percentage of the people who were picked up in prostitution arrests are actually the pimps or the Johns. It's always the women who are being victimized by the criminal justice system.
Yeah, Bob, that being said, what they need may be one thing. If it's not there for you, this would at least allow them some restitution.
Perhaps it would. As you know, there are already laws like this on the books in several other states. But as one person brought up, is the prostitute going to be able to get a lawyer who's going to be able to take this to court for her? Are the prostitutes even going to know about it? And oftentimes, as was brought up, you know, these are women who have serious other issues. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be wanting to go to court.
And George Curry, one would think that the pimps themselves wouldn't necessarily be so ready to shell out any money, even if the legal system suggested that.
Well, I guess if we talked about pimp juice yesterday, we had to talk about the pimps today.
I guess so. Yeah. We can't get away from it.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you can enforce this. I really don't. I mean, I think Laura pointed out that, you know, basically the prostitutes and the Johns are the one who gets prosecuted. Pimps are prosecuted 1% or less of the cases. And by the time a person gets ready to go to court and sue a pimp, you know, a lot of things have transpired. They knew prostitutes do need help. They need services. And efforts that will help get them off of the street or prevent them from going on the street would be even better. I just don't see how you're going to really enforce this.
How much of this speaks to the idea, Laura, of what has become an age-old problem in many, many cities, and that's the idea of the inability to enforce rulings against prostitution? It just seems like prostitution is one of those things that will not go away. It just moves from corner to corner, and one does not see the true enforcement, as you suggested, with the help for these women, as one might think in today's age.
I think that's a really great point. I think there's two issues there. One is the stigma associated with this crime, the discomfort that people have with it. That's one reason why you don't get the kinds of support in some of the support for some of the things like drug treatment and HIV. People just see these people as criminals. They're stigmatized. And also, I think it's a sexism issue. I think that the reason why police and law enforcement don't go after the men is because they're men, and it's easier to go after the women. They're more vulnerable, especially when you're talking about the Johns. When you look at communities in Chicago where this is very prevalent, many of these Johns come in from wealthier communities outside the community. The cops go after the women and re-victimize the women in many ways.
All right, let's move on to another issue, and that's the United States' outreach to the Islamic world. We heard the Bush administration suggest that they were going to have new olive branches for what is called by the media the Islamic world. Karen Hughes, a good friend to the president, was appointed about a month ago to craft a new approach to U.S. Diplomatic relations with these countries. Interestingly enough, though, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, released a report that criticized the administration for failing to develop a strategy to improve the image of the United States, as, quote, recent poll data has shown that anti-Americanism is spreading and deepening around the world. And interestingly enough, also in this outreach effort, the State Department's main program has no Muslim members on its staff. So one has to question how well they may go about doing this kind of outreach, George Curry.
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous to say we're going to try to bring in Muslim organizations and country, just let them hear our story, and therefore they'll fall in line and say, be part of this great democracy movement. It's not going to happen that way. Islam is the fastest growing religion in America, and in a couple of years it'll be the second largest. So it is a major issue, and it's directly tied with our security in terms of how we are perceived abroad. But we just can't limit it to what kind of photo ops there are, what kind of interviews there are. You still got to deal with the fundamental issues to why many Muslims hate America, and it goes back to our media's policy.
How much do you buy, Laura Washington, that the United States government and, frankly, many Americans are willing to really take a look at why the Islamic world has such a problem with the United States?
Well, I think that the U.S. government doesn't have a lot of credibility on that claim. one choosing Karen Hughes. I understand the Bush, she's a close ally, close friend of his, and he sees this as a, he says, he has said this is sending a signal that I'm serious, that I would put someone that is close to me in charge. But Karen Hughes does not have the kind of experience or the kind of background that would lend credibility to the claim that we want to reach out, we want to have a dialogue. She's a master marketer, she's an image maker, she's an image builder, but that's about it. And the fact that she's, that, you know, there's going to be this long delay in putting her and her administration in place. And as has been mentioned earlier, they haven't really been serious. I mean, 9/11 happened a long time ago. We've known we've had this issue for years, and they haven't been serious about putting people in place in key positions in the State Department who understand this community, who are Muslim, who speak Arabic. And I think until they start taking those kinds of steps, you can't take them very seriously.
Yeah, Bob Meadows, you write for People Magazine. Image is everything. So that being said, if you want to improve your image, why not bring someone like Karen?
I was just about to say, Ed. The thing about this is, you know, the Council on American Islamic Relations said they like Hughes in this position because they know she's got Bush's ear. Karen Hughes is Bush's most trusted advisor, and she's the best spin doctor this country has ever seen. Bush, when Bush's drunk driving thing came out during his campaign in 2000, Karen Hughes was right there to spin that, and all of a sudden Bush is, well, became president.
But we need more than spin.
She can make, you know, people love George Bush, she may have an opportunity to make the Arab world love the United States.
Now, George, neither Kerr, she nor anybody else. Question. You beat me neither to the question, and that is whether or not that sends a signal. If Karen Hughes, as she is known in many circles as a great spin doctor, does that say that what we're trying to do here is spin an image versus counter what we have done in the past?
It says that we are definitely interested in image. It doesn't say we're interested in substance. I mean, how can you have an outreach to a group and don't have a member of that group as leading it or a major part of it? It's like you have these Republicans and Democrats all have these outreach programs. Republicans sending outreach to African Americans. They find some they put out front, and they say, we want to connect to your community. You don't come here and get a woman from Texas who has no experience in diplomacy and say, this is our outreach to the Muslim world. It makes no sense.
All right, let's move on to our last question of the day, and that is, what is a continuing question? And that is debt relief for African nations. At the spring meeting of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, we heard from Mr. Wolfowitz, who will be taking over, and he suggests that his first trip in relation to heading the bank will be to Africa, that he's been plowing through stacks of material on the bank's operation, and he indeed wants to change the situation and give more monies to these indebted nations. Now, many finance ministers of some African countries are suggesting that they're worried that there will be ultimately a shift of attention under Mr. Wolfowitz, and they will continue to be in debt.
It's not just African nations. It's lots of developing nations worry about that. A lot of Asian countries have been buying up as much capital as they can, specifically because in the late 90s, when they went through their stock crisis, they didn't like the way the World Bank and IMF gave out their loans. They didn't like the terms of those loans. What I found really interesting, though, is that Bush has actually increased the amount of aid that America gives over what Clinton has. I find that very interesting, but we're still far, far short. The United States gives more money than any other country, but we're still far, far short of reaching our goals.
Yeah, we give more than any other country, but we're at rock bottom in terms of our ability to give. As a percentage of our annual income, we are at the rock bottom. And Tony Blair has called for a doubling of that, because they set these same kinds of goals in year 2000 and not even close to reaching it. So that certainly needs to be a redoubling of efforts.
I think it's encouraging that Paul Wolfowitz has decided to go to Africa first, and I anxiously await to see his response to what he sees there. You know, poverty extreme poverty in Africa is falling behind every other continent, and so there's a lot of work to be done there. And he's also got a pretty long learning curve. He doesn't know that much about this issue, and I also am very concerned that he has made it very clear up till now that Iraq and the Middle East and the democratization of the Middle East has been his priority, and I wonder if that's going to change.
Do you buy what you hear from the World Bank, the IMF, and, as you mentioned, Tony Blair, that there is a real want to get these nations out of debt?
I think that's certainly true in the part of Tony Blair. But if judged by how we've acted in the past, I think the commitment is not there. The words are there, but the commitments are not. And quite frankly, we really have no choice if we're really talking about dealing with global hunger and poverty, that the donor nations are the key to that, and they really hold the key to the whole future of Africa.
But, Bob, I would suspect that many of those in those donor nations are saying, how long are we going to hear this song?
Absolutely. Just the fact that Wolfowitz is taking control. A lot of countries feel that the U.S. didn't consult them enough on this, so this is just one more issue. The countries have been hearing this for years and years and years of this debt relief, and it's something that's never really taken shape.
Mm-hmm. No, but what we've got to do, though, look at what has happened to extreme poverty. You know, since, I think, 1981, I mean, it's double in Africa. We got more than 300 million people there who are living on $1 or $2 a day. I mean, this is serious, and it's a growing problem. So it's not just a single sum. This is an urgent crisis that needs to be addressed.
And related to that, of course, is the AIDS crisis, which has not been at the top of the list in terms of these discussions around the World Bank. But, you know, absolutely, there's a very direct correlation between poverty in Africa and other countries and AIDS. And that's something that really has to be dealt with, you know, yesterday.
It seems like one of the things that people are really relying on here with AIDS, with poverty, is that they're expecting a lot of private donors to step forward and not have governments take place. I know that in certain African countries, Ethiopia, what have you, they're waiting for private donors to give money so that they can get new drugs for the to treat HIV.
Well, it also seems to me that the whispers that don't want to often be heard in this question of whether or not these nations will be rescued from debt is the whole question of race, frankly, not just of African nations, but as you mentioned, Bob, some of the other nations of color that find themselves indebted. And one still has to question whether or not we would see these in countries in Europe and other places. So that's something I think that will have to be dealt with forthrightly and upfront before we really see any change. Bob Meadows, writer for People Magazine, Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist and DePaul University professor, and George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. I thank you all for joining us. Appreciate it.